It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here as we discuss Native American elders developing Alzheimer's disease and the reality of health disparities, the barriers to care and associated costs. The Alzheimer's Association says as many as 1 in 3 Native American elders will develop Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. Join in with your questions, your thoughts on this, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Adrienne Johnson is here, assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She is a licensed clinical psychologist at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention and lead author of a recent article published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Adrienne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You found dementia diagnoses among Indigenous people over age 65. It costs $880 million to $1.9 billion annually. Can you put that into perspective for us? What do those costs mean?
So what we did was we looked at Wisconsin Department of Health Services data, and we were trying to compare the cost of people who had dementia, Indigenous peoples who had dementia, versus those who did not. And we found that the added cost of a dementia diagnosis was exactly what you said, $880 million to $1.9 billion annually. And that's the cost across the country. The interesting thing that we also found is that when we went more broadly and we thought about misdiagnosis of dementia, given that about half of people with dementia aren't actually diagnosed, we estimated that the cost of dementia and misdiagnosis in American Indian and Alaska Native costs an additional $1.2 to $2.5 billion per year.
Where would the misdiagnosis be coming from? What do you mean by that?
Great question. So when we looked at the misdiagnosis, the things that we kind of added into our statistical models were malnutrition and adult failure to thrive. And those may be signs of dementia, but it's important to note that we were doing this research while looking at Department of Health Service electronic health record data. We know that some of the misdiagnoses come from really people not coming in to see their healthcare provider. It's also potentially due to beliefs that it's from other issues. So there's a variety of problems in terms of accurately diagnosing dementia, and we do have very good standards to diagnose dementia.
This Wisconsin electronic health data you pulled, it could be analyzed in myriad ways. What made you interested in looking at it through this lens?
Well, we were really interested in highlighting the importance of dementia diagnosis in American Indian and Alaska Native peoples. And one way to show importance is cost. So we wanted to show, given that unfortunately no one has looked at the cost of dementia in American Indian populations broadly, that it was a very high cost. And that was something that our reviewers definitely noted, that it felt especially high.
Your analysis also mentioned that there is likely an undercount. Why would there be an undercount?
The undercount is for a variety of reasons. One is that misdiagnosis piece that we already discussed. So we were looking at health record data, and the people that we included in the dementia diagnosis were those who had a dementia diagnosis. Again, about half of people with dementia aren't accurately diagnosed. So that's one form. Another piece is that we are looking at American Indian and Alaska Native adults, and we looked at Medicaid eligible state program eligible data. We didn't look at Indian Health Service data, which is another smaller pot of money, and that is like the primary source of health services for American Indians. So there's even more money we're not looking into at this point that is accounting for that added cost of dementia. And then the last piece is that we know in terms of the national census, American Indians are generally undercounted. So when we used our Wisconsin data to estimate the national cost of dementia, we had to note that there may be an undercount of the amount of American Indians in this country, and that may be therefore lowering the potential amount that we're estimating.
It would factor into what you're seeing as well. Yes. Talking about new research into the costs of Alzheimer's and related dementias with Adrian Johnson with us, a clinical psychologist at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. You can join in with your questions about this research, about Alzheimer's and what you have experienced, 800-642-1234. Adrian, what could policymakers take from your research?
I think one of the biggest takes is to really highlight the extreme cost of dementia in American Indian peoples, and as best we can, to potentially highlighting the importance of allocating money for the treatment and prevention of this disease. I work very strongly in the prevention field personally. And one of the things I want to highlight is when thinking about those resources, speaking to Indigenous peoples, speaking to them to say, what is the best way to use this? How can we best help?
What is the trajectory, I guess, for Alzheimer's and related dementias in Native populations? As you look out into decades to come, where is this disease headed?
Yes. So unfortunately, it's not looking good. You mentioned earlier that as many as 1 in 3 Native American elders will develop Alzheimer's disease or some form of dementia. So by 2060, that number of individuals 65 and older who are American Indian or Alaska Natives living with dementia is expected to increase fourfold. So that's a huge, huge increase. And a lot of that is due to preventable factors like smoking, which is something I look into, but also alcohol use and diabetes and a variety of other issues.
As you mentioned there, the input of tribal leaders when developing programs to address Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, why is that input so critical?
Well, we did this work, and really the work of Carrie Gleason, co-author on this project, with the eye towards genuine community engagement and the notion that if you're going to allocate resources towards a community, it's important to determine what that community truly needs for it to have the biggest impact. And Dr. Gleason is working with the Oneida Nations here in Wisconsin to try to understand that better.
We have clinical psychologist Adrian Johnson, who has analyzed healthcare cost electronic data and Native Americans battling Alzheimer's. She's based at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Call in with your questions about Alzheimer's and meeting the healthcare needs of Indigenous communities, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the high financial and healthcare burdens and disparities of Indigenous elders living with Alzheimer's. This is Wisconsin health data contributing to new insights on the health inequities, published recently in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Join in with your questions, your comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Clinical psychologist Adrian Johnson is an assistant professor at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, studying the impacts specifically on smoking and brain health. You know, help us unpack smoking and brain health. What is the relationship between the two?
Yes.
So smoking accounts for up to a 70% increased risk in Alzheimer's disease onset. And smoking in more recent data accounts for at least 5 to 6% of current Alzheimer's and dementia cases overall in the United States. That number is even higher internationally. So we know that smoking is a very large modifiable risk factor for dementia, meaning a risk factor that we can change, which is especially important.
What is the tobacco doing to the brain specifically?
So there's some research suggesting that the main biological process is through oxidative stress, and that's what's causing some of the brain issues. But there's been less work focused on the direct connection between smoking and Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of research supporting the indirect relation between smoking. We know that it increases at least five risk factors for dementia, including diabetes, heart attack, blood pressure, and a variety of others. So there's definitely more work to be done, and that's something I'm particularly interested in.
Right, because smoking can, tighten and damage blood vessels, which would be a bad thing for the brain, restricting blood flow to the brain. Is that,
Exactly.
and when you look at vascular dementia in particular, is that the issue there with the effects on the brain health and the blood flow?
So that is definitely one of the large components, and I think you said it perfectly. It makes sense that we know smoking causes issues cardiovascular. So of course that would cause issues in the brain, but unfortunately that's been less looked at than other health issues. We know about cancer, we know about heart issues, and a variety of other things. For vascular dementia, which is the second most common form of dementia, that is kind of the notion that that's how that's causing those issues. But I think it's really important to note that smoking also increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common form of dementia and one that's particularly scary and difficult to think about.
So, there have been a look. There has been a look at what nicotine does with dementia. Is there research that you can help us understand the effects of nicotine on brain health?
That's a really great question. So nicotine is the main addictive ingredient in cigarettes. And we've actually seen that nicotine is a stimulant, meaning it can kind of increase in short periods our attention and our ability to focus. There is research that's being done now to look at whether nicotine patches, which are what people sometimes use to help them quit smoking, can help treat mild cognitive impairment, which is kind of right before dementia. But it's really important to note that nicotine is not the only ingredient in cigarettes. There are thousands of chemicals in cigarettes that cause huge amounts of damage in the body. So sometimes there's a misconception that because nicotine may be helpful in some ways as an individual ingredient, then of course cigarettes will be helpful. And that's actually been shown to be incorrect. There was a meta-analysis in 2010 by Cataldo and colleagues that showed that the influence of the tobacco industry also really affected the suggested link between smoking and dementia. And when those people who were not affiliated with the tobacco industry showed their results, there was clearly a negative effect of cigarette smoking on dementia of all forms.
Yeah, the other carcinogens don't just fade away into the backdrop, and it's just
Exactly.
so. I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we look at the relationship between smoking and brain health with Adrienne Johnson, an assistant professor at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. You can join in 800-642-1234. John in Boaz. John, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, I have done some research to help dementia, and I think that reliving good memories, including music, is very entertaining for people with dementia.
Music therapy and its impact on dementia. Adrian, can you go that direction?
Yeah, I can. So I think that's a great point, and there is a little bit of work supporting music therapy. There's actually also a large component of both singing and engaging in that activity, and there's work being done in Milwaukee associated with the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute to do a choir and to have that both social connection and singing be a form of treatment for those who have dementia. So I agree and I appreciate you bringing that up.
How do you get someone who is suffering from dementia, how do you get them to stop smoking or start on that path to stop smoking?
Yeah, so one of the biggest things that we want to keep in mind is that there's different phases or levels of dementia. And when we get to different levels, the further on, the more severe and functionally impaired an individual might be. So when we're talking about earlier stages, we really want them to do the same thing that we would have individuals who don't have dementia. First is to use some form of evidence-based treatment, and that could be nicotine replacement therapy. There's also two other medications that we know work. And there's counseling, and that counseling is very behaviorally focused. It's focused on when do you smoke? What else can you do in that time? Setting a quit date, for example. And one thing I really want to highlight is that in Wisconsin and across the nation, we have the quit line, which is 1-800-QUIT-NOW, and that can offer free treatment and medication. But for American Indians, specifically in Wisconsin, there is the American Indian quit line, and that is 1-888-724-7848, and that can offer up to 12 weeks of free medication to help you quit.
Really great resources there. And you're currently focused on the messaging regarding smoking cessation. What are the methods of smoking cessation you're investigating?
Yes. So one of the big things I'm trying to highlight for the community, both the medical and general community, is the link between smoking and dementia, and that within as little as 3 years of quitting, your risk of developing dementia, if you don't already have it, can be comparable to somebody who has never smoked. So the types of treatment to your question that we focus on are those same evidence-based treatments that we talked about. And the messaging, which we started by really asking older adults who do smoke, what messages would you want to hear? We asked them, would dementia be a motivational message? Would dementia, that risk and ways to lower that risk be helpful? And the overwhelming answer we got, was yes. So that was particularly motivating. So we've developed those messages and we're currently testing them now, and that research is ongoing.
What about resolutions or saying, hey, I'm going to start something on Monday? I'm going to, what about personal motivation like that with resolutions?
It's a great time for quitting smoking and making changes. And setting a date that's within the next 2 weeks is especially important because we know our motivation goes up and down. And setting a specific date, whether it be this Monday or another day, is a great way to start. The other things to keep in mind for smoking cessation are clearing out your space, your house, your car, your pockets in your winter coat of cigarettes and lighters and other things that make it easier to have a lapse because it is a very addictive substance and we want to set you up for success.
So really going through your entire environment and all your patterns to make sure that they are clear and you won't have these things, you won't have any things to really trip you up or to tempt you in order to
Exactly.
stay with that goal. I want to bring this back to Native elders for just a moment because you hypothesized that Native elders with Alzheimer's would incur significant incremental costs compared to those without Alzheimer's. Can you explain what those incremental costs would be? What that means?
Yes. So again, we were looking at health record data. And when we say incremental costs is in our statistical analyses, we compared controls who did not have dementia were matched with cases of individuals who did have dementia. And we matched across subclasses that we knew were important. So age group, sex, county type, whether it's rural or urban or reservation land, but also diabetes status and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or emphysema status, and whether they've had a myocardial infarction. So we were looking at other things that we know are expensive. They incur costs in terms of the health outcomes, but also saying if we match these two individuals on at least a few variables, what is the added cost of dementia? And that's where those numbers of 880 million to 1.9 billion annually came from.
Adrian, thank you for sharing your research with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adrian Johnson is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health based at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. We have a link to her article and resources at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We head to Capitol Hill now with Republican U.S. Representative Brian Stile of Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. As the 118th Congress takes shape, we discuss his legislative priorities as House Republicans prepare to wield new power. And we get reaction to Representative Kevin McCarthy winning the speakership after some conservative Republicans staged a revolt against the party leader. Call in along the way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Congressman Brian Stile's district includes Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. Representative Stile, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
So the House Speaker vote took 15 tense rounds of voting. You experienced it yourself over those 5 days. What is your reaction to Congressman Kevin McCarthy of California gaining the speakership?
I think what you saw play out on the TVs across the country was actually just your democracy in action. Democracy was designed to be a little bit messy. And instead of negotiating all that out before the vote, it was negotiated out on the floor. But I think at the end of the day, what you really see is an alignment of Republicans in the House who want to turn the tide on the reckless spending that's occurred in Washington for the past 2 years. And so now it's our opportunity to come together and put a check on 2 years of reckless spending in Washington.
But whether behind closed doors or on the floor, what Americans saw transpire raises questions about whether there will be perpetual gridlock over the next 2 years and frankly, more chaos. What do you say to Wisconsinites who are worried that basic functions of Congress won't get done?
Well, I think what you actually saw was folks coming together at the end of the day. There's a lot of frustration about how Congress has operated over the past 2 years, about the spending packages that went through Congress over the last 2 years, about the inability of the previous speaker to be able to really address the biggest challenges that our country is facing. That frustration spilled out onto the House floor. But at the end of the day, I think you actually really saw people coming back together. You got to think about the 222 members that came together at the end for the speaker's vote as if you brought over your entire family for a Thanksgiving dinner, all 222 of them. And the first order of business was to pick who was going to carve the turkey. Not lost on anyone that there's going to be some squabbling, some debates. But at the end of the day, it took a little longer than we would have liked, or than at least I would have liked. But at the end of the day, I think what you saw was a cohesive unit coming out of there saying we have to address the biggest challenges our country is facing.
Do you feel Republicans are a cohesive unit?
Yes, no, I do. I think you have 222 people that all bring their own ideas to the table, all come from every stripe and background, every geographic region from across our country. And so it is not a monolithic group of individuals. It is a group of individuals who have strong views about the direction we need to take our country. But at the end of the day, the key priorities here are bringing costs down, about unleashing American energy, about making our communities safe. I do think there's significant alignment. I think we have a great opportunity to move forward and really help Americans who've been struggling to pay the bills over the course of the last few years.
On Monday, the House narrowly passed a rules package that governs how the House will operate, and you voted in favor of the rules package. Can you explain why?
The rules really just set up how is the House going to operate over the course of the next 2 years. And the rules package that was more or less negotiated as part of the speaker vote really sets us up, I think, for success. It sets us up that says members can bring amendments to the floor. We haven't seen that in years now in Washington, to be able to actually approve bills. It says that we're going to actually get 72 hours, three full days to review and read bills. You remember just a few weeks ago, in the waning days of Nancy Pelosi's speakership, she brought forward a $1.7 trillion spending bill and jammed it through without time for folks to fully appreciate and understand what's in the bill. I think those reforms are positive. I think they're going to help us focus our spending in Washington. And everyone's going to benefit if we actually allow members to review, analyze, and improve by amending bills on the House floor.
What do you make of the motion to vacate the chair, the procedural tool used to remove the speaker, you know, allowing a single member to move to vote to unseat the speaker?
What we've really just done is return to historical precedent. So, you know, you only have to go back about 10, 15, 20 years. And that was the rule that was always in place. And no one ever discussed it. It became an issue following John Boehner, Speaker Pelosi to consolidate her power, struck that ability of members to bring that vote to the floor in any reasonable manner. All we were doing, I think, is watching us return back to the precedent that had been in the House for years. And again, I think you're going to see this Republican majority come through and actually be able to address the biggest challenges we're facing. And there's none bigger than the inflation that's clobbering American families right now.
Do you feel you know your colleagues in the Freedom Caucus and ultimately what they want the Republican Party to become?
You know, I have a unique opportunity to meet all 435 members. I spend a lot of time with my colleagues from all backgrounds. Now, sometimes you'll see folks from the left, from the right, come together on issues that aren't partisan. Often that plays out in the case of making sure we're helping our veterans. And so from the broad array of the Republican Party, there's great thoughtful members that are members of the Freedom Caucus. There's great thoughtful members that are members of the more moderate wing of the Republican Party.
But are you concerned about the concessions, the backroom deals that Speaker McCarthy made with the Freedom Caucus?
No, I think what we're going to actually see is the Republican Party come together. I think the difference here that everybody needs to remember, right, is Nancy Pelosi actually did backroom deals. The floor discussions that you saw were actually in front of the American people, and the changes to the rules were put forward in very clear, observable ways. I think what you actually saw was how democracy was structured to take place and allowing the American people unfettered access to watch that, while new, because it's open and available and accessible, it's new for people who haven't been in the House and watching from the galleries before. It's actually the process that's played out over the course of hundreds of years, or the past 200 years of American history.
So what we saw was just completely normal, how Congress normally works. It just was exposed in a way that's different.
I think if you sat in the House chamber and watched other votes that were jammed through, if you go back to when the $1.7 trillion was spent, there was an alignment to jam that bill through, and the American people didn't have an opportunity to read and review the bill before it went for a vote. Contrast that with this rules package, which had weeks or days of public discussion and debate. I think that's actually, at the end of the day, that's good. It's messy. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think it's a bad thing for the American people to actually get an opportunity to see how these bills come together and contrast that again with the $1.7 trillion in spending, which was truly negotiated behind closed doors. And the American people never had an opportunity to read it, review it, provide advice and comments before that bill was voted on the House floor.
Talking with Representative Brian Stile of Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. You can join the conversation along the way, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about spending. Yesterday, we talked with Democratic Representative Gwen Moore, your colleague across the aisle, about the prospects of a government shutdown. And Moore said Republicans want to link raising the federal debt ceiling with cuts to entitlement programs. And she cited Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. Does that capture what Republicans are seeking?
No, I think that's the consistent scare tactics of those that want to make seniors concerned. Seniors should be concerned from the Democrats' reckless spending that has put us in the position that's going to be really difficult for America to pay their bills. What I'm focused on is making sure that we're protecting programs, in particular Social Security and Medicare for our seniors. The way that we can protect those programs is to writ large get our spending under control. The debt ceiling vote that will come before Congress in the months ahead is really the result of the reckless spending of the past. Think of it as a debate of, do you pay off your credit card? Why do you have the credit card debt in the first place? Well, because you went on a spending binge previously. So now we've come into the House in this Congress, and we have to significantly address the fact that year after year, we're spending way beyond our means in Washington. We need to have an adult conversation about our priorities and about the long-term trajectory that's going to be required to get our country back on track. And it's all the more essential because we're faced with high inflation due to, in large part, the reckless spending that we've seen play out in Washington over the past 2 years.
But, you know, not to allow a debt increase without spending cuts, that, you know, that's going to be a really big lift in a divided government. Is allowing a debt default something Wisconsinites should be worried about?
You can't allow your federal government to default on its debt. And I think you see that across the board of all rational members. The question is, at what point are we going to have the adult conversation in the room to address the long-term trajectory of spending in this country? The trajectory that we've been placed on from the past, really going back decades, right? There is a pox on all houses. But the challenge for this Congress in particular is to come and say, okay, that problem, that reckless spending has accelerated dramatically in the past few years. How do we as a country want to come together to get this trajectory back on track? And there are consequences for the reckless spending that we have seen Washington do time and time again. And there's no consequence that's more dangerous than the inflation that we see where wages aren't keeping up with rising costs. Families across our state and across our country aren't able to afford the things that they need because of the inflation that's being driven in large part by the wild and reckless spending that we've seen come out of Washington previously.
And as a follow-up there, Steve called and wants to know what you mean by wild and reckless spending and what government services would be on the chopping block.
So over the course of the last 2 years, new spending, meaning new spending in addition to the baseline spending that your federal government has done, increased by $6.8 trillion. The debt last year went up north of $1 trillion. And again, Congress in Washington has been driving spending in a reckless manner for far too long. But we saw a very reckless increase in the acceleration of that spending and a disconnect from the growth of the economy over the course of the last 2 years. So we have to have a conversation, come back to the table and say, what is the plan to get us back in line where we can get our country back to normal, where we can bring inflation down? And we're going to have that conversation in the House and in the Senate and in the White House, because ultimately, if we fail to do that, you're going to see inflation continue and families are going to find it harder and harder to get by.
But in your mind, would it be the defense budget? Would it be the USDA? Would it be transportation? Would it be HUD? Veterans health? Where do you see the cuts?
I think that's the conversation that needs to play out. One, we can look at the efficiency of how we deliver a lot of our medical care. We have opportunities to make dramatic improvements in the efficiency in which we deliver that, not removing the quality of the product, but thinking through how do you cut through some of the bureaucratic process that's not value additive. That is going to be a major conversation that we have to have as a country and find those efficiencies and address the fact that special interests would rather be paid in their pockets than actually address and find ways to deliver those products more efficiently. We've seen the reckless spending come out of Washington in a whole host of programs, including direct transfers to states. You see the state of Wisconsin sitting on a multi-billion dollar surplus. Why? Because the federal government gave those funds to the state. Those are the kinds of questions that we're going to have to ask going forward to make sure we can get our country back on track.
Republican Representative Brian Stile, district in the southeastern part of the state, with us as the work of the 118th Congress gets underway. And we saw the first piece of legislation to pass would cut the IRS budget. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with U.S. Republican Representative Brian Stile. On the line represents the district, including Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. Previously served as ranking member of the Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness and Growth, and on the Committee on House Administration, and House Financial Services Committee as well. We're going to now go to Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, what's on your mind?
Thank you. What's on my mind is that the representative is right. The American people are going to be paying extremely strict attention to whatever plans the Republican Party finally comes up with, including the record of the Republican Party to move for tax cuts during the Trump administration, which were never really paid for except to advance further income inequality in the society. I would want the representative to detail, as you have asked, whatever specific plans for specific programs the Republicans have in mind, because trust me, the American people are paying attention, and there was no red wave in November.
Rich, let's go to Representative Stile. Go ahead.
Let's talk about the tax cuts, because I think it's really important, because many of those key provisions begin to expire in the years ahead. I think we need to make those cuts permanent. I think in actual contrast to what the caller said, we actually saw inequality following the tax cuts decrease. If you remember back before the pandemic, we saw real wages rising faster than inflation, meaning people were coming home and able to buy more things every single day that they went out to work. But the rise in wages actually increased the fastest for the least amongst us. Above the average for real rising wages was Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, women, veterans. And that's exactly what we should be focused on, putting forward an economic growth plan that helps the least amongst us. We contrast that in sharp terms with what played out as we came out of the pandemic, where we actually have seen American wages falling in real terms, not keeping up with rising prices. And who gets hurt the most in an inflationary environment are two groups: retirees on fixed incomes and low-income workers. Low-income workers have taken it on the chin from the inflation that we've seen over the last 2 years. Now is our opportunity to go back to the policies that we know work, allow Americans to put more money in their pocket, and in particular, help the least amongst us.
When we talked with Representative Gwen Moore, she mentioned the child tax credit and lifting so many children out of poverty. Would you support that going forward?
I think the key of the child tax credit, and in many ways that has been a very successful program, and in many ways it was dramatically and unfortunately changed in the previous few years. What we need to do in particular as it relates to the child tax credit, as it relates to many of our other key programs, is to tie those programs back to work. There's a dignity to work, but it also is shown that time and again, folks who find themselves in difficult situations, the best thing to help you move back up and into a sustainable middle class is a job. And what we watched over the past few years was many of our key programs that are essential to lower income workers or people who find themselves in difficult situations, is that those programs were disconnected from the incentive to work. And we have to keep work as a key component of our ability to help people sustainably maintain themselves in the middle class.
Okay, so making sure that there are those stipulations and strings attached to get those safety net government benefits. That's what I'm hearing?
In particular, tying these benefit programs to work. We only have to go back into the beginning of those first bills that came out under one-party Democratic control. Many of those key programs were no longer connected to work, and the results were draconian, in particular amongst folks who we need to help the most. And so we have actually seen the least amongst us fall further and further behind as inflation's reared its ugly head, and we've allowed too many people to find themselves on the sidelines rather than being in the workforce.
Talking with Republican representative of the 1st Congressional District, Brian Stile, with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Matt in Greenville is with us. Matt, what would you like to bring up?
Yeah, so talking a little bit about inflation, you had brought up government spending as what sounded like a key driver of it. There was a report a couple months back that said corporate greed was actually a larger piece of what was causing our inflation. So how do you really manage and justify potentially making large cuts to government spending when there's these other factors that are driving and potentially driving inflation more?
Matt, thank you. Representative Stile.
I actually asked the Department of Justice from the Biden administration this exact question. And what you're going to see is that is not the key driver. And if you go back to the San Francisco Federal Reserve report that actually dives into this, it is the reckless spending. It is the energy policies and the war on energy that are driving energy costs up. And it's our labor policies that have allowed and found too many people finding themselves on the sidelines. Corporations should always be reviewed and kept in check to make sure that they're not abusing the position that they find themselves in. But I haven't had anybody come to me and say that the Biden administration has dramatically shifted policies such that have allowed corporations to behave in a way different than they had in the past. And I've continued to challenge the Biden administration to say, if you believe that, point to me to the policy that changed that has allowed these corporations to do that today versus before. The real key here is to get our spending in check, address the energy crisis that's playing out across our country, and to allow people to get themselves back to work. If we do those three key things, we can actually meaningfully and substantively address the inflation crisis that we're feeling every day.
Only a few seconds left. We saw the bill yesterday to roll back the IRS funding. You voted in favor of the measure. What concerns you most about the IRS funding?
The 87,000 IRS agents that the Biden administration wanted to hire would have been utilized to harass everyday Americans. You got to remember, 87,000 people is about the size of Camp Randall or Lambeau Field on any given Sunday or Saturday as we look out to next year's football season. And in particular, what we need to do is make sure that we're not harassing everyday Americans who are out there working. And that is the reason you got to pull that back to allow folks to be able to go out, earn their living, and not be harassed by their federal government.
Congressman Stile, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Stile is the Republican U.S. Representative for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, including Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha, first elected in 2018. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.